There's also a fight taking place in Alaska, where the Interior Department held hearings this week as part of a plan to put together a five-year energy proposal. The debate centers on the question of drilling for energy on the outer continental shelf. So this is drilling for energy well off the shore of Alaska in Arctic waters. After 2 days of public testimony, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar pronounced Alaskans passionate and divided. Salazar got an earful from those for and against drilling for oil and gas. Elizabeth Arnold has this report.
Block 7012, one bid.
Just over a year ago, the oil industry bid a record-breaking $2.6 billion for oil and gas leases in the Chukchi Sea. The sale was staggering.
The highest bid was $105,304,581 by Shell Gulf of Mexico.
Shell had already bought leases even further north and was ready with rigs when then-President George Bush lifted the ban on drilling along the outer continental shelf. Shell Alaska General Manager Pete Slaby.
So we're drill bit ready to move in the Arctic right now, and this is stuff that can happen right now. And, with a few things going our way, we will be ready to go in 2010.
But those few things are now largely in the hands of Secretary Salazar, who came to Alaska this week as part of the process of developing this administration's offshore energy plan. He's called a time out on new leasing for more public input, and he got plenty yesterday. Whaling Captain and Barrel Mayor Edward Itta advised slowing down.
Mr. Secretary, like all Alaskans, the people of the North Slope depend on the economic engine of oil and gas development. We have supported onshore for well over 30 years now. But Mr. Secretary, offshore is a different matter.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin advised speeding up.
Delays or major restrictions in accessing our needed resources for environmentally responsible development are not in the nation's or our state's best interest.
From laborers in hard hats chanting jobs, 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 to environmentalists dressed as polar bears and puffins, division and emotion over offshore drilling was apparent. Shell Alaska General Manager Slaby says it's unjustified.
In Alaska, we live in the shadow of the Exxon Valdez. I strongly disagree with those who say that we have learned nothing. If you look at the total volume of oil that winds up in the world's oceans, less than 1%.
A pretty good record, he says, and adds that over the years, more than 100 exploratory wells have already been drilled in U.S. and Canadian Arctic waters without an accident.
None. None.
Nothing.
None.
But concern over offshore drilling in Arctic waters doesn't just center on spills. The Interior Department is also responsible for endangered species, and an increasing number of marine mammals and seabirds in the Arctic are in decline. The fear is that the impacts of a warming climate will be compounded by new development. This is the sound of spring in the northern Bering Sea, a 400-foot icebreaker backing and ramming through the ice pack. Some 30 scientists are on board this ship conducting research on just about everything from walrus to ice algae. In the bowels of this icebreaker, University of Wyoming researcher Jim LaVorin studies a seabird with white eye patches, the spectacled eider, one of about 350,000 that's left of the world's population that breeds here in the Arctic. On both hands, he counts off other species in danger, Steller's eiders, king eiders, and common eiders.
You've got red-throated loons, you've got yellow-billed loons, four-eyed seals, you've got the walrus, you've got bowhead whales. You could not find a more sensitive habitat.
On the same ship, USGS research ecologist Chad Jay is tracking the Pacific walrus, which is also under consideration for listing, and like the polar bear, could be the next symbol of climate change. Reductions in the extent of ice over the last few years have forced walruses onto small pieces of remnant ice, and in 2007, there was no ice at all near the shelf.
As a result of that, we saw in Alaska upwards of 6,000 walruses hauling out along the shore of northwest Alaska, which is their first ever. And it means that a greater number of animals are using a smaller space to forage in and to haul out on. Probably not a good thing.
But the very thing that's cause for concern with regard to walrus and other species here in the Arctic is what's made drilling in these waters more attractive to industry, less sea ice. And it's posing a major policy decision for the new Department of Interior. weather and how to balance development of what's both a fragile ecosystem and what some believe to be the next best answer to America's thirst for oil. Salazar says he doesn't expect to make everybody happy. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Anchorage.
Now a little eco-vocabulary lesson. Seed balls. If you go to YouTube and search the term, you'll find a surprising number of entries, all for a technique of planting on abandoned and often inhospitable land. Seed balls were developed in Japan, but they're now being used all over the U.S. by local organizations that want to spruce up their neighborhoods. NPR's Margot Adler caught up with one group throwing seed balls in Brooklyn.
First of all, here's how you make seed balls. Here's Emily Gallagher, a member of NAG, Neighbors Allied for Good Growth, a group active in the Greenpoint and Williamsburg areas of Brooklyn.
Well, first we mix the mulch and a seed mixture. We tried to pick a seed that is native to this area and also can withstand drought. So we mixed those together, and then we kneaded it like bread into a red terracotta clay.
Then they roll it into little balls, lay them out to dry, put them in bags, and distribute them. The mud and clay protect the seeds from being eaten by birds and rodents. After 3 to 5 rains, they break down and the seeds germinate. The seeds used here are wildflowers, mostly purple and blue, like the lovely blue cornflowers you often see by the roadside. The technique was developed by Masanobu Fukuoka, who specialized in natural farming. So, on a Sunday afternoon, I find myself walking the streets of Greenpoint in Brooklyn with members of NAG. They hand me a small paper bag with little brown balls. I'm to drop them on dirt piles and throw them into abandoned lots.
Oops. This one went on concrete. I don't think concrete's going to work.
Kind of push them down a little bit, but not too much.
She's throwing it over a high wood wall.
If only my gym teacher could see me now.
Greenpoint and Williamsburg in Brooklyn have been gentrifying. There's been lots of development with little attention to open space. But right now, with the economy in crisis, a lot of the development is on hold. Michael Friedman Schnapp is one of the co-chairs of NAG. He says community gardening and what was called the guerrilla gardening movement of the 1970s...
It was a reaction to all the abandonment that was happening in the city at the time. And, you know, here we're at the end of a development boom, and it's clear that the city's resources are going to be constrained, and they're not going to be able to take care of everywhere in the city, and so it's going to rely on citizens stepping up and taking care of their own surroundings.
In fact, as we are walking around, I notice a lot of fenced-in areas. One right on the waterfront even has the little maple leaf that signifies City Park, but it's locked with a chain-link fence. And you can see people sneaking into abandoned, trash-filled areas near the river, finding places to fish, to jog, to walk their dogs. Gallagher hopes throwing a few seed balls will make these places more welcoming.
And I think it's really important to break down these larger tasks of taking back our neighborhoods and cleaning up our open spaces into tasks that are completely doable.
It's not clear that it's totally legal throwing seed balls into abandoned lots, but so far no one here is complaining. After all, most people don't even know what seed balls are. Back in 2003, during some WTO protest, police surrounded a parking lot concerned that some strange pellets might be dangerous weapons. They were seed balls. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
The EPA called the asbestos poisoning in Libby, Montana, the most horrific environmental disaster in the country's history. More than 200 deaths and thousands of illnesses have been linked to a vermiculite mine in that town. And for the last 7 weeks, 5 former executives of the chemical company, W.R. Grace, have been on trial in federal criminal court in Missoula, Montana. They're being prosecuted on charges of conspiracy and violating the Clean Air Act. At issue, did the company knowingly expose workers and residents to asbestos from that vermiculite mine, and did they conspire to conceal the dangers? Tristan Scott has been covering the trial for the Missoulian newspaper. And Tristan, the government's going to be wrapping up its case pretty soon. It cut back on its witness list. What is the crux of the prosecution's case?
Well, the prosecution's case, and they've been plodding along for about 25 days now, so everybody's feeling a little bit battle-weary. So far, jurors have heard about these reams of data that Grace gathered about the hazards of its vermiculite products and about how Grace executives understood those dangers through extensive product testing and air sampling, soil sampling, and even mortality studies on Libby workers. There's also been testimony from a chest doctor who's diagnosed 1,800 Libby residents with asbestos-related disease. There's also been testimony from little leaguers who played on the local ball fields and who are now sick because Grace lined the base paths with vermiculite, which contained asbestos, and other residents who said they used to play on piles of the vermiculite around town or put it in their gardens and lawns.
Well, last week, the federal judge, Donald Malloy, who's hearing this case, got very impatient with the prosecutors, with the jury out of the courtroom. He had some very sharp words for the government. What did he say?
Well, Judge Malloy, outside of the jurors' presence, issued a very stern rebuke to prosecutors, telling them that their conspiracy theory was not coming to fruition, and he admonished them to move their case along. The prosecutors have presented a lot of internal documents spelling out these hazards of asbestos in Libby, but Malloy says that a bunch of names on the copy lines of corporate memos don't prove a conspiracy to do that. The prosecutors have to show proof that the defendants made an actual agreement to commit a crime, and so far, Malloy says prosecutors haven't been able to show that.
When it's time for the defense to present its case, how do you expect them to do that, to try to fight back this conspiracy charge?
Well, the defense, a major theme of the defense so far has been that government prosecutors are misleading the jurors. And I think what they'll do is they've already announced that they'll present a former Grace executive who's not on trial, who's gonna refute a lot of the testimony that the government prosecutors have presented.
Is part of W.R. Grace's defense also that look, the dangers were widely known in the time frame that this trial is considering. There was no cover-up here. Even the government knew about the dangers of this asbestos.
That's exactly right. Numerous studies had been disclosed to the EPA about mortality rates in Libby, as well as the harmful nature of this vermiculite and its propensity to release asbestos fibers. This Libby vermiculite crumbles very easily and the asbestos fibers become airborne.
Tristan, this case of Libby, Montana is so notorious in the state. Are people there following this trial very closely?
Yeah, I think they are. And in the courtroom, there's been a pretty regular cast of characters, Libby residents who have asbestos-related disease, activists who have long said that Grace should be held criminally accountable for its actions. And just around western Montana, I think there's a lot of interest that's been generated by the trial. That said, it's not as cinematic as I think a lot of people thought it would be. There's a lot of long, tedious testimony about scientific sampling, and there's been a lot of that kind of testimony.
Tristan Scott is a reporter for the Missoulian newspaper in Missoula, Montana. Tristan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Regulators in California are taking aim at all those big flat-screen TVs that people have been snapping up in recent years. The televisions use a lot of electricity, so now California's Energy Commission has proposed new TV energy efficiency standards. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
There are an estimated 35 million TV sets in California, and the State Energy Commission estimates that those TVs and things consumers plug into them account for about 10% of the electricity used in a home. That figure could climb as people upgrade to larger screens and HD TVs, which consume more energy. The Energy Commission's proposal would impose tougher energy standards on TV sets sold beginning in 2011. The agency's Adam Gottlieb says the price of the TV shouldn't increase, but consumers would reap savings on their electric bill.
We are looking at putting these regulations into place to save Californians between $50 and $250 on their television over the life of the television. So if you have more than one TV in your home, you're looking at significant savings.
While the proposal has the support of some TV makers and the state's largest electric utilities, the Consumer Electronics Association says the proposed standards are unnecessary and unwise and could prompt retailers to cut back on merchandise, reducing the number of jobs. Moreover, the association's Doug Johnson says Americans are already choosing new TVs that meet EPA's voluntary Energy Star standards.
And that's great for energy savings. It's a testament to competitiveness. So what we have with Energy Star really is a well-functioning government program.
The California proposal will be voted on this summer. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Sales of bottled water have stopped going up after years of double-digit increases. The industry is under attack by a tough economy and also by environmentalists. Here's Nancy Cohen, a member station WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut.
Decades ago, when people were thirsty, they looked for a water fountain or turned on the tap.
What did it taste like? Is there a specific taste to it?
Tastes like water.
All right, try another one.
Caitlin Korner-Doloff from the group Corporate Accountability International is running a taste test at the University of Hartford to convince students there's not much difference between bottled water and tap.
This is actually tap water, the last one, which we thought was Aquafina. Cup D was Hartford, West Hartford tap water.
Okay.
Criticism of bottled water was first sparked a couple of years ago when concern about dependence on fossil fuels coincided with a rise in bottled water consumption. Environmentalists have been calling for people to give up the bottle ever since and for states to increase recycling. Now, the entire bottled water market is down 1%.
Anecdotally, we believe that consumers last year increasingly drank more tap water.
Gary Hempel tracks sales for the Beverage Marketing Corporation. He says the sale of most non-alcoholic beverages fell last year because of the economy. But he says with water, there may be another issue.
The secondary reason, perhaps a little bit more difficult to measure, but nonetheless probably a factor, are environmental questions.
Attack on the bottle isn't only coming from environmentalists. Bottled water competitors like Brita, which sells water filters, launched an ad campaign knocking the bottle. NPR aired them this month. But bottled water is still selling. Americans spent more than $11 billion on it last year. Kim Jeffrey is CEO of Nestle Waters North America, which owns Poland Spring and 14 other brands. He says if environmental concerns are influencing sales, they're not having much of an impact.
The problems we're seeing right now are very, very much attributable to the economic downturn, not to the fact that people are leaving bottled water in droves, because it's just not happening.
At Geisler's supermarket in East Windsor, Connecticut, some people are buying two cases or 48 bottles a week. Other customers are cutting back.
I used to buy a case once in a while, but I don't anymore.
And why is that?
Probably watching my pennies.
Linda Lamar is a special ed consultant who's now down to a couple of bottles a week. Lenny Witten, a plumber, used to buy a case a week, but now fills the same bottle with tap water over and over.
Just because of the landfill, you know, just filling up landfills with the plastic and it just doesn't decompose.
Kim Jeffrey says his company is trying to use less plastic resin. A half liter of Poland Spring used to be made from 14.5 grams.
Today, it's less than 12.5 grams. That move down saved us about 65 million pounds of resin a year and had about a 10% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions. But the fact that the bottle's still there suggests that we have more work to do, and that's in the area of recycling.
Jeffrey says we should have curbside recycling for everyone, but bottled water critics still want fewer bottles. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Cohen.
If you're so inclined, this might be a good time to hug a tree. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, new research suggests that global warming could cause massive tree die-offs in the future.
There's a lot of fairly basic stuff that scientists don't really know about trees.
Like, what does it take to kill a tree? And do warmer temperatures matter in terms of killing trees?
David Brashears spends a lot of time studying trees. He's at the University of Arizona in Tucson. About a decade ago, he got involved in a project that looked at tree die-offs following drought. He compared the number of trees that died in a 1950s drought that hit the Colorado-Arizona-New Mexico area with a drought that struck a similar area in 2000. More trees appeared to die in 2000, even though the droughts lasted about the same time. That led Brashears to wonder,
is warmer temperature on top of drought going to be a problem for us in terms of really triggering a lot more mortality than we've had in the past.
So he and some colleagues decided to do an experiment. They uprooted 20 mature pinyon pine trees from a ranch near Ojitos Frios in New Mexico and trucked them approximately 600 miles to Biosphere 2 in the Arizona desert outside Tucson. Biosphere 2 was originally built to prove that humans could live in a closed, self-contained ecosystem. But the project ran into problems, and now the facility is basically a giant greenhouse with different climate zones inside. Brashear's colleague Henry Adams says they put the trees into two areas.
We made one area as cool as possible,
so that it resembled the cooler climate of the tree's native New Mexico. The others were put in another area that was about 8 degrees warmer.
What we did is stop watering half of the trees in both of those spaces.
And then they waited.
What we saw was that trees in the warmer area died 30% faster on average than trees in the ambient temperature area.
In other words, the warmer temperatures made the trees significantly more vulnerable to drought. Adams reports these findings in the current issue of the journal PNAS. Dave Brashears says these results spell trouble for trees if the expected global warming comes to pass.
If lots of areas have warmer conditions and periodic drought, if what we see for this pinyon pine species also applies to other widespread tree species, then there's potential that we could have a lot of die-off in a lot of places.
Although the results don't come as a major surprise, Phil Van Mankim says it's one thing to suspect something and another to demonstrate it scientifically. He's a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Service Western Ecological Research Center in Arcata, California.
It was important to do this sort of work just to demonstrate that this, in fact, does occur in biological systems.
The new study represents a kind of scientific revival for Biosphere 2. Earlier this decade, it was basically abandoned as a research facility, but in 2007, the University of Arizona took it over. Travis Huxman is now the director. He says Biosphere 2 offers scientists a chance to do experiments on a scale that begins to resemble the great outdoors rather than a laboratory bench.
It's a $250 million facility, and it's been sitting in our backyard for some time, and we feel an obligation to try to figure out, you know, something to do with it.
Huxman says, stay tuned, there's more to come. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.